Hello, good afternoon, and thank you once again for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your host, Diana, here with you every Saturday to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. To start off with the holidays in full swing, I thought I would read from this historical article about how America observed Christmas at home and abroad during World War II. Christmas in 1941 was little different for most Americans from that of the previous year, despite the calamity of Pearl Harbor only weeks before. Both coasts had begun to post anti-aircraft guns, some obsolete, others wooden fakes, only there for spurious confidence. Sentries, often bearing 1918 vintage rifles, were seen at railway stations and armaments factories, and anxiety about Japanese air raids had resulted in the relocation of the New Year's Day Rose Bowl from Pasadena, California, to Durham, North Carolina, where Duke would play Oregon State. Yet, shops everywhere burgeoned with holiday goods. Christmas trees were plentiful, and in the traditional Christmas extravaganza at Radio City Music Hall in New York, the Rockettes worked hard to dance away any gloom. Everywhere across the nation, the Japanese were being thwarted in the Terry and the Pirates comic strip. And Gary Cooper, as Sergeant York, was defeating the Germans single-handedly in the previous World War. The hit book for Christmas giving, at a hefty $2.50, was Edna Ferber's Reconstruction-era romance, Saratoga Trunk. For the same price, War turned up bombastically and distantly in a two-disc set of the 1812 Overture, performed by Artur Rodzinski and the Cleveland Orchestra. Gift crates of oranges and grapefruit from Florida were $2.79 at Bloomingdale's. Hattie Carnegie's dresses began at $15, while the Rogers Pete menswear store offered suits and topcoats from $38. Meanwhile, at recruiting stations, the Army was offering smart khaki garb gratis. Henry Bendel featured silk stockings at $1.25 a pair. Stockings in the current Wonder Weave nylon sold for $1.65. Nylon stockings would be almost non-existent by the following Christmas, when the fabric would be the stuff of parachutes. Among the Christmas toy glut, shops across America advertised a remote control bomber at $1.98 that ran along a suspended wire to attack a battleship. The Japanese had not needed suspended wires at Pearl Harbor or in the Philippines, Malaya, or Hong Kong. The Royal Navy's principal ships in the Pacific were at the bottom of the Gulf of Siam, and the depleted American fleet had only two destroyers available between Vancouver and San Diego. On the other side of the continent, Winston Churchill crossed the Atlantic on the new battleship Duke of York amid violent, frigid gales for a late December meeting with President Roosevelt. The American brass was worried about having the prime minister at the president's elbow, where he could employ his glib persuasiveness and imperial visions despite his very weak hand. At precisely 4:30 p.m. on Christmas Eve, as dusk gathered and the temperature dropped, the red-coated Marine band on the White House lawn struck up Joy to the World, accompanying choirs from area churches. Thousands had gathered in the fading light. After some further carols, the band began Hail to the Chief. As the sunset gun at nearby Fort Myer boomed, the President and Mrs. Roosevelt appeared on the south portico with a group of guests, and only then did Churchill's arrival in the United States become news. Roosevelt pressed a button signaling the lighting of the National Christmas Tree, as if wartime blackouts elsewhere had no relevance. The band encored Joy to the World, but there was little joy in Washington. The British and American conferees worked through Christmas on joint planning, breaking in late afternoon for holiday dinner. Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, who rarely hosted formal dinners at Fort Myer, invited some of the British contingent. When Catherine Marshall discovered belatedly that December the 25th was Field Marshal Sir John Dill's birthday, she sent Sergeant James W. Powder, her husband's paragon of efficiency, to find a cake and candles. Despite holiday closings, he returned with both, and also with miniature British and American flags to press into the icing. Dill, confiding that he had not had a birthday party since he was a small boy, plucked the flags to cut the cake and discovered they were stamped "Made in Japan." Then, because Powder had thought of almost everything, a Western Union messenger brought a single telegram, which was intercepted by a Secret Service detail. There was wartime security somewhere. During the first full year of war, defense and withdrawal metamorphosed into offense and reoccupation, both in the South Pacific and in the Mediterranean. The costs were showing up at home, even in small things. Nationwide gas rationing began on December 1, 1942, 4 gallons a month, later reduced to 3. That in a 35-mile-per-hour victory speed limit kept holiday revelers close to home. Although merchants were calling the 1942 Christmas tree supply pre-war normal, the number of fathers at home to buy, transport, and trim them had dwindled. In small-town America, boys with absent heads of households were taken under the wing of World War I veterans from such organizations as the VFW and the American Legion. That year, and on wartime Christmases to come, these surrogate fathers delivered trees to Blue and Gold Star houses and ensured that gifts materialized beneath them. Many service fathers did not have much of a Christmas, particularly those who'd been taken prisoner in the Philippines and shipped, if they made it alive through December, to Japanese POW camps in Formosa and Manchuria. Major General Edward P. King, Jr., the commander of Filipino-American forces on Bataan, recalled a carol sing-along with other officer POWs and the special holiday treat they were given with their gruel, an apple. That Christmas, General Douglas MacArthur was supervising the retaking of New Guinea from his new command post in Australia. The commander of the 8th Army, Lieutenant General Robert Eichelberger, sent him a present from the front in Buna, a dead Japanese officer's ornate sword. In French North Africa, which the Allies had invaded in early November, Lieutenant General Dwight Eisenhower received a more significant gift. The month before, he had made an odious but seemingly necessary deal to get the Vichy forces to surrender by appointing the chief collaborationist on the scene, Fleet Admiral Francois Darlan, as head of the French state. On Christmas Eve, a young Frenchman named Fernand Bonnier de la Chapelle shot Darlan. He died on Christmas Day. In mid-1943, Allied forces jumped from North Africa to Sicily, then to the boot of Italy. During Christmas of that year, while Anglo-American troops were clawing their way up Italy, Eisenhower and his staff were in Algiers, entertained by the visiting Winston Churchill, who was recuperating from pneumonia in a seaside villa Ike had provided. Presiding in a padded silk Chinese dressing gown, Churchill conferred there with high brass on Christmas Day about further landings in Italy. A festive luncheon followed with turkey and plum pudding. In the Southwest Pacific, Americans involved in the costly island hopping toward the Philippines and Japan were hardly aware of the holiday. On Bougainville in the Solomon Islands, soldiers and Marines were fighting the tenacious Japanese ridge by ridge. The 1st Marine Division spent its Christmas on pitching LSTs before going ashore on the New Britain the next day. POW Edward King was at a small camp in Manchuria where for Christmas the Japanese, quote, gave us a little pork and a piece of bread. The 16 officers in the camp, British, Dutch, and American, improvised a religious service and sang what carols they remembered. None of them would have known Irving Berlin's White Christmas, which had been introduced by Bing Crosby the previous year in the film Holiday Inn, and was now being broadcast by Armed Forces Radio everywhere Americans could listen. I'll Be Home for Christmas was the latest hit, but as the lyrics explained, that joyous return home might occur only in my dreams. At home, metal toys for Christmas had nearly disappeared, along with bicycles, typewriters, alarm clocks, and other hard goods, gift items large and small. In 1943, zinc had replaced copper in pennies, but kids expected more than the unfamiliar dull coins from Santa. Opportunistic growers again loaded up on Christmas trees, raised prices, and, according to one overstocked wholesaler, quote, kept cutting right up to the night before Christmas. While certain things were in short supply, bacon, butter, sugar, lamb chops, Kleenex, and new shoes, to name a few, Christmas trees were not among them. 10 million evergreens went unsold. Following D-Day in June 1944, the home front began to smell victory ahead. That winter, the cost of Christmas trees dropped sharply. Trees that had been priced at $4 the year before were now $2.50, while trees sold on the stump ranged from 25 cents to 45 cents for the fewer fathers around to cut them. Continuing deprivations included silk for dresses, cuffs on trousers, whiskey for grown-ups, and bubblegum for kids. The Office of Price Administration announced the return of canned vegetables to the ration list and increased restrictions on butter, sugar, and meats. On Christmas Eve, President Roosevelt spoke to the nation and the armed forces by radio from his home at Hyde Park, saying, quote, "The Christmas spirit lives tonight in the bitter cold of the front lines in Europe and in the heat of the jungles and swamps of Burma and the Pacific Islands." From an NBC studio, Bob Hope broadcast to seamen on a Liberty ship about to weigh anchor for a Pacific destination, telling them that he knew it took courage to transport a cargo of ammunition. Terry of the Pirates Strip risked his own White Christmas by flying munitions over the icebound Himalayan hump to China. MacArthur's men, as he labeled all the troops in his command, were on Leyte in the central Philippines, where they had driven the Japanese into a corner of the island. On Christmas Eve, the general paced after dark on the veranda of an elegant house vacated by the enemy command. As he puffed on his corncob pipe, a group of GIs gathered below to sing carols in a steamy climate and setting far removed from the typical American Christmas. Suddenly, a low-flying Japanese nuisance raider buzzed over the compound. The singing abruptly stopped, and soldiers dived for the hedges. Then searchlights caught the intruder in their crossbeams, and a burst of anti-aircraft fire dropped it. MacArthur leaned down to thank the returning carolers, and then resumed his pacing. In Europe, Christmas brought the climax of The Bulge, the dismaying German surprise attack in the forest of the Ardennes that added further misery to a harsh winter. In the days approaching it, only the encircled and bypassed crossroads town of Bastogne stood between the Wehrmacht and the banks of the Meuse. But on December 23rd, the snowy skies cleared briefly, and previously grounded supporting aircraft could finally pound the enemy. For many beleaguered Americans, it was already too late. Two regiments of the 106th Infantry Division and much of the 28th Infantry Division had been shattered. And thousands of GIs, those still alive, would spend a cold Christmas in windowless boxcars clattering eastward toward German prison camps. RAF bombers interdicted one train on December 25th, killing 60 Americans, including two doctors. Survivors kept spirits up by singing carols. A fortunate few received a potato for Christmas. Some POWs held in the United States that Christmas fared a good bit better. At Fort Dix, New Jersey, 21 lightly secured Italian POWs escaped, had Christmas dinners with hospitable families nearby on whose farms they had worked, and returned happily to camp to face useless AWOL charges. Undeterred by the weather, Lieutenant General George S. Patton's Third Army was pushing north to relieve Bastogne and break the German siege. They were still on the move on Christmas Day when Patton jeeped among his units in the snow to ensure that, at the least, his troops got hot turkey sandwiches with gravy. It may not have been much, but it would have been a feast to POW Edward King, now in occupied China, who knew it was Christmas only because of the marks he made on a crude notebook calendar. Patton hurried off between inspections to placid Luxembourg City, enjoying Christmas dinner at General Omar Bradley's well-stocked mess at the Alpha Hotel, where his staff trimmed a tree with scraps from the tinted window of a downed bomber. On Christmas Day, at Eisenhower's headquarters in Versailles, the mess offered roast turkey with all the traditional trimmings and champagne. The general opened his gifts from home, including fancy bedroom slippers from Mammy. Far to the east, the battle to flatten the bulge still raged. That's all for this story. It was originally published in World War II magazine. Up next, another holiday-related story, this one concerning military culture. Santa's elves have been busy bringing cheer to military families. Whether a service member is single or married, deployed or otherwise living thousands of miles away, it's difficult being away from family. Troops and families are often involved in formal or informal activities to make the holidays better for the military community. Whether it's spouse clubs baking cookies for troops living in barracks, parties for military families to provide food, or toys for children. However, plenty of others are at work during the holidays, and some all year long, to bring some extra cheer to troops and families. Now, here's a curated list of activities that have been happening around the globe this holiday season, including military families who give back to their local community. A number of organizations have long-standing traditions of events for military families, not just during the holidays, but all year. The nonprofit Operation Homefront has served more than 13,000 military families at about 100 holiday events across the country this season. Their holiday meals for military primarily supports junior enlisted military families. Families received meal kits and/or pantry staples and grocery gift cards. Armed Services YMCA's branches around the country provide different Operation Holiday Joy events, such as allowing military families to go in and shop for gifts for their children, such as toys, books, and bikes. Some chapters, such as Killeen, Texas, near Fort Hood, deliver the fixings for holiday meals. That YMCA chapter alone has provided 2,400 people with holiday meals, while the Alaska Armed Services YMCA hosted a winter holiday train for 450 riders on December 7th. Army Emergency Relief distributed over $150,000 in $100 gift cards to soldiers in 34 Army units around the globe from Germany to Korea, said Sean Ryan, spokesman for AER, Installation Sergeants Major and Installation Sergeant Audie Murphy. Club members helped with the distribution. The nonprofit Trees for Troops has provided 326,273 fresh Christmas trees to service members since 2005. And while they are still tallying the numbers, they expect to exceed 19,000 trees this year at 94 bases, said Rick Dungy, Executive Director of Trees for Troops. The trees are supplied by more than 300 family-owned Christmas tree farms in more than 25 states. Troops are feasting. The Defense Logistics Agency has already delivered the fixings for holiday meals for troops stationed around the world. While planning starts in the spring, they had to pivot to meet challenges, including when the Gerald Ford Carrier Strike Group was diverted to the U.S. Southern Command to support Operation Southern Spear. Another challenge was avian bird flu import restrictions in Japan, which hindered the prime vendor from finding turkeys for service members there. They located turkeys elsewhere that met the requirements and were able to ship the birds into Japan, officials said in a press release. Giving back to others. Military families have a tradition of giving back, and that often steps up during the holidays. Throughout the holiday season, treats and necessities were delivered to veterans at local VA hospitals, as well as to families staying at the local Fisher House. Others continued to help feed the needy and bring some Christmas cheer to children's hospitals or orphanages. For example, Air Force's 492nd Fighter Squadron hosts an annual Christmas party for the East Anglia Children's Hospices in Cambridge, England. Operation Santa Claus has provided gifts, toys, backpacks and books to children in remote Alaskan communities since 1956. The Alaska Air and Army National Guard and the Department of Homeland Security, along with volunteers from the Salvation Army and the Alaska National Guard Child and Youth Program, hosted families from Kipnuk and Quiggillingok at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, Alaska, on December 14, 2025. This year's event supported families who were displaced following Typhoon Halong. All right, up next, How about this article here about even more connections between military history and the holidays? How the Civil War inspired this iconic poet's classic Christmas song. Charles Appleton Longfellow was the oldest child of American poet and writer Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. A dramatized version of Charlie's story was recently made into the movie I Heard the Bells. But the true story behind the origins of the Christmastime poem turned song is just as, if not more, interesting. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow vehemently objected to his son's desire to enlist in the Union Army. But in 1863, at the age of 18, Charlie ran away from home and enlisted in the 1st Massachusetts Artillery. He informed his father of his decision in a letter mailed from Portland, Maine, saying, quote, "I have tried hard to resist the temptation of going without your leave, but I cannot any longer," he wrote. "I feel it is my first duty to do what I can for my country, and I would willingly lay down my life for it if it would be of any good." Within 2 weeks of his arrival, likely because of his famous father's connections, Longfellow was commissioned a second lieutenant in the 1st Massachusetts Cavalry. On November 27, 1863, while involved in a skirmish during a Battle of the Mine Run campaign, Charlie was shot through the left shoulder. The bullet exited under his right shoulder blade and skimmed his spine. The wound was considered grave, and the army surgeon told the elder Longfellow that paralysis might ensue for his son. On Christmas Day, 1863, as his son recovered from his wounds, Henry penned the poem, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, with many references to Civil War. It goes a little something like this. The cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound, the carols drowned, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent, and made forlorn the households born, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head, there is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong, and mocks the song, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep, God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Charlie would survive his wounds, did not return to the war. He kept in touch with friends made during his brief career as a soldier, receiving letters and photographs from them and creating a scrapbook of newspaper articles relating to his unit's role in the war. He went on to become a world traveler and author. All right, I'd like to end our time with this last holiday-related story, the real story of how NORAD began tracking Santa Claus. On a snowy night in December 1955, at the height of the Cold War, a red hotline rang ominously in the Combat Operations Center at Continental Air Command, predecessor of North American Aerospace Defense Command in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The private phone to Washington, D.C. was only to be used in the event of a national emergency. Think DEFCON 1 with nuclear missiles and Soviet bombers flying over the North Pole. The watch commander that night, Air Force Colonel Harry Shoup, answered the phone with appropriate gravitas, expecting to hear unspeakable news of pending global annihilation from a 4-star general. Shoup instead listened as a tiny voice innocently asked, "Are you Santa Claus?" At first, Shoup was angry. Normally stern and serious, the by-the-book career officer thought someone at the Cold War defense bunker with sophisticated radar tracking equipment was playing a careless and potentially dangerous joke. He demanded to know the name of the caller, who then began to cry. That's when Shoup realized he really was speaking with a child on the other end of the confidential line. Backpedaling, the colonel calmed the child, then asked to speak to their mother. Shoup asked her how they got the unlisted number. She told him it was published in a newspaper ad by the local Sears department store so children could call and talk to Santa. That's how NORAD began tracking the jolly old fellow on Christmas Eve 70 years ago, formerly known today as NORAD Tracks Santa. Well, that's the legend anyway. What really happened is a bit different, but fascinating nonetheless. Colonel Shoup played the part, said Brigadier General Stephen Gorski, NORAD and U.S. Northern Command Director of Intelligence. He assured the child that he was not in fact Santa Claus, but his job was to track Santa Claus and make sure that he stayed safe. That started the lore in the history of NORAD tracks Santa. As with many historical events, the legend often obscures the fact. As time passed, Shoup claimed he told the child he was Santa and gave assurances that he was on schedule to deliver all gifts in time for Christmas. Later versions of the story also had that first encounter taking place on Christmas Eve. In reality, the original phone call occurred November 30th, 1955. A wire story carried in newspapers across the country the next day reported that Shoup handled the call in which the youngster wanted to know if this was St. Nicholas at the top of the world. To this day, it is unclear whether it was a misdialed number or a misprint in the original Sears newspaper ad. According to the article, the colonel's response, which seems to better fit his personality, was, quote, "There may be a guy called Santa Claus at the North Pole, but he's not the one I worry about coming from that direction." From there, the myth grew incrementally with each passing year. Later versions described how American and Canadian military jets scrambled to intercept the bogey and then escort the sleigh with 8 tiny reindeer on its appointed rounds. Each year, media outlets carried stories on Christmas Eve about Santa Claus being directed on NORAD tracking systems as he headed south on his annual pilgrimage. Today, 70 years later, that initial wrong number has become a PR bonanza for the U.S. Air Force. NORAD Track Santa is a major project that now includes a website in multiple languages and a Christmas Eve call center at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado Springs, staffed by more than 1,000 military and civilian volunteers to speak with anxious children wondering about Jolly St. Nick's progress. Translators are available to handle multiple foreign languages. This program is now so popular that volunteers handle some 380,000 calls, while the website, which features games, updates, live radar of Santa's sleigh, and other activities, garners some 2.3 million hits annually on Christmas Eve. Well, that's all the time I have. Thank you once again for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your host, Diana, signing out.